Hello, it's the 6th of October and welcome to our Thursday edition of Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The United Nations Security Council has failed to agree on a response to North Korea's recent intermediate-range ballistic missile launch, with China and Russia defending the regime's actions. We'll have more details in news briefing shortly. Later on Korean Politics Digest, we discuss the government's plan to abolish the Gender Equality Ministry and potential plans to establish a new agency for Korean nationals abroad. And then coming up on Explore Korea, we learn about the biggest performing arts festival in Korea, the Welcome Daengno Festival. We have all that and more on today's Korea 24.
DPRK has enjoyed blanket protection from two members of this council. These two members have gone out of their way to justify the DPRK's repeated provocations and block every attempt to update the sanctions regime. In short, two permanent members of the Security Council.
That was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, speaking during a U.N. Security Council meeting in New York on Wednesday. Her barbed comments were directed at permanent members China and Russia, after the 15-member body failed to come to an agreement on a response to North Korea's firing of an intermediate-range ballistic missile. Hours later, North Korea fired two more short-range ballistic missiles towards the East Sea on Thursday. Our KBS World Radio News editor, Koo Hee-jin, joins us in the studio now to debrief us on the UNSC's closed-door session, as well as the latest North Korean provocation. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang.
So there were some heated exchanges at the UNSC meeting, which yet again did not yield a joint agreement. Mm-hmm. Representatives from China and Russia once again spoke in North Korea's defense. Let's listen to what China's Deputy Permanent Representative Geng Shuang and Deputy Russian Ambassador Anna Evstigneva had to say.
We call on the U.S. to take concrete actions, demonstrate its sincerity, and effectively address the legitimate and reasonable concerns of the DPRK so as to create conditions for the resumption of dialogue.
It is obvious that the missile launch by Pyongyang is a consequence of short-sighted confrontational military activity surrounding this country conducted by the United States, which hurts their own partners in the region and also hurts the situation in Northeast Asia as a whole.
So, Hee-jin, with two out of five permanent members of the UNSC throwing roadblocks, there was no joint statement condemning North Korea then?
No possibility of it. The council had called the meeting after the North fired, as you said, an intermediate range ballistic missile, or IRBM, over Japan on Tuesday, which forced Tokyo to issue an emergency alert in its northern region. Following the trajectory over Japan, the North Korean missile, presumed to be the nuclear-capable Hwasong-12, flew 4,500 kilometers, the furthest for a North Korean ballistic missile to date. South Korean ambassador to UN Hwang Jung-guk blamed Moscow, arguing that Pyongyang is taking advantage of Russia's war against Ukraine to advance its nuclear weapons program. Japanese ambassador Ishikane Kimihiro said the North's move is absolutely unacceptable. Let's listen to the remarks by the ambassadors.
Today's global security and economic environment has become increasingly fragile and uncertain, particularly as a result of the Russian Federation's aggression on Ukraine. Against this troubling backdrop, the DPRK is taking advantage of the distraction of the international community and further accelerating the development of its nuclear and missile programs. The DPRK recently promulgated its new law on nuclear weapons policy on September 8th, which set the threshold for using nuclear weapons far lower than any other country.
Among these launches, the latest one was especially significant. It flew over Japan and impacted in the Pacific Ocean for the first time since 2017. I assume we can all imagine how terrifying it must be to see a missile flying overhead. This is absolutely unacceptable, and Japan condemns it in the strongest possible terms.
Now, after the UNSC meeting ended in stalemate, the US, South Korea, Japan, and some of the Council's member states issued a statement condemning the North's recent series of ballistic missile launches. Still, the countries noted that they remain committed to diplomacy and urged the North to return to dialogue.
Later on Thursday afternoon, President Yoon Suk-yeol held a phone conversation with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, details of which are just coming through. This comes after North Korea shot off two short-range missile launches early in the day. It's sixth such launch in 12 days. So can you tell us what we know of the conversation and also North Korea's latest provocation?
Yes, President Yoon and Prime Minister Kishida talked on the phone for 25 minutes late Thursday afternoon to confer on North Korea's mounting provocations. The two leaders formed a consensus on the grave nature of the launches and agreed to cooperate on formulating a stern response. And South Korea's JCS said North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles from the Samsok area in Pyongyang between 6.01 a.m. and 6.23 a.m. The JCS said the first missile traveled about 350 kilometers at a speed of Mach 5, reaching an altitude of some 80 kilometers, while the second flew about 800 kilometers at a speed of Mach 6 at an altitude of some 60 kilometers. North Korea has launched 9 short-range and 1 mid-range ballistic missile in 6 launches within a span of just 12 days, starting the 25th of September. Japanese Prime Minister Kishida denounced the North's latest launch, telling reporters that North Korea's ballistic missile launches are absolutely unacceptable and ordered a full analysis of the latest launch to provide quick and accurate information to the people of Japan. Meanwhile, South Korea, the US, and Japan held joint maritime drills in the East Sea for the second consecutive week. The Joint Chiefs of Staff announced on Thursday that the USS Ronald Reagan, which had headed out into the Pacific Ocean after last week's maneuvers, made a U-turn to join South Korea's Sejong the Great class Aegis destroyer and Japan's Shokai Aegis ship in another round of exercises. For the first time, the three nations have held ocean drills for 2 straight weeks.
Okay, let's turn now to some other headlines for today. The Yoon Suk-yeol administration has announced its government restructuring plan, which includes scrapping the Gender Equality Ministry and setting up a new agency for ethnic Koreans abroad. Can you tell us more?
Well, Interior Minister Lee Sang-min announced the plans during a press conference on Thursday, confirming that the Ministry of Gender Equality and Family is on the chopping block, with most of its functions moving to a new department under the Health Ministry. The plan also includes a new agency for overseas Koreans under the Foreign Affairs Ministry, while the Ministry of Patriots and Veterans Affairs will be elevated to a cabinet-level department in place of the Gender Equality Ministry to maintain the number of cabinet members at 18. The prospect of plans passing the National Assembly is uncertain, however, with the main opposition Democratic Party, with a majority in the chamber, seemingly averse to the idea of abolishing the Gender Equality Ministry.
Yes, we'll be talking more about these plans in our Korean Politics Digest segment later in the show as well. Meanwhile, construction has finished on the nation's deepest underground research facility in the eastern Gangwon province, where scientists will work to unlock the mysteries of the universe. Heejin, can you tell us more?
Well, the Ministry of Science and ICT and the Institute for Basic Sciences held a ceremony to celebrate the completion of the YEMI Lab on Thursday, the sixth largest of its kind in the world, 5 years after the ministry approved its construction. Located 1,000 metres under Mount YEMI and spanning 3,000 square metres, this lab will carry out studies on the creation of the universe and its composition through the detection of dark matter and the measurement of neutrinos. Such studies require the greatest possible reduction in background noise and cosmic rays, prompting countries like the US and Canada to competitively build such labs deep underground, thus enabling world-class physicians to discuss discover more about the universe and its origins.
Let's get a quick update on the COVID-19 situation in South Korea as well. Can you brief us through the latest numbers?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported that 28,648 infections were reported on Thursday, bringing the cumulative caseload to around 24,911,000. The figure is down about 2,000 from a week ago, marking the lowest in 13 weeks for Thursday tallies. The number of patients in critical care dropped by 8 from the previous day to 325, the lowest in about 2 months.
And finally, the 17th London Korean Film Festival will kick off in Britain's capital city on November 3rd for a 14-day run. Can you give us the details of the festivities?
Well, organised by the Korean Cultural Centre UK, the event will feature 44 South Korean films of various genres at 9 theatres in London, as well as screens in Manchester and Glasgow. Director Choi Dong-hoon's Alienoid will open the festival, while Hansan, Rising Dragon by director Kim Han-min, will close out the event. The upcoming festivities will include a special focus strand dedicated to the late South Korean actress Kang Soo-hyun, and five key films from her career will be screened, including the 1986 film The Surrogate Woman, directed by Im Gwon-taek, for which Kang won Best Actress at the 1987 Venice Film Festival. The special screenings category will feature Broker by award-winning Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. The film, starring Song Kang-ho, was selected for the competition section of the 75th Cannes Film Festival, with Song nabbing South Korea's first Best Actor award at Cannes.
That's all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
The Yoon administration this week announced plans to follow through on one of President Yoon Suk-yeol's most controversial campaign pledges, that's to abolish the Gender Equality Ministry. The Vice Interior Minister Han Chang-sup explained on Wednesday that the functions of the ministry will be transferred to a division under the Health and Welfare Ministry. Meanwhile, the government also said it will look to establish a new government agency for Korean nationals abroad. To discuss these plans today for Korean Politics Digest, we have first joining us on the line Law Professor Song Se-ryeon from Gyeonggi University. Hello, Professor Song.
Hello.
And here in the studio, we have with us Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-ju from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies as well. Professor Kim, it's great to see you again.
Great to see you.
Okay, so if we start with the Gender Equality Ministry, the official announcement of the plan came earlier today, but it had been talked about for the last few days. It requires revisions to the Government Organization Act, and essentially the plan is to abolish the ministry, but it's not going to disappear entirely. It will be downgraded to a division within the Health and Welfare Ministry. As I mentioned, this was an election campaign pledge by President Yoon. Professor Song, let me turn to you first. What do you make of this plan?
Well, as you said, this is a campaign pledge, and that carries a message in terms of the direction of this issue. Of course, gender equality is very important, so is family issues. Likewise, youth issues are very key issues. But I think the controversy comes from, first of all, the way the ministry has been run and kinds of controversies it generated. And also, I think, you know, there is a sense that this gender issue should be taken into account in the context. In Korea, there were times, I think, that the issue turns on whether you are a woman or not. And just because you're a woman, because of the historical baggages that comes with it in terms of how, as a society, we treated women, the special treatment was warranted. But at this point, I think that the women issues are better handled in the context of women in the workplace, women in the family setting, what kind of benefits they get from the government. So a lot of problems that, that we hear has been coming from a lack of coordination with other necessary departments, and the message has been across, and maybe issues kind of flashed too much on the victimized status of women. So if it is a campaign pledge, and if the Yoon Suk-yeol was elected on his platforms, I think he's entitled to have a opportunity to push those policies the way he sees fit. Now, it doesn't mean that the opposition party cannot question it. I think they should. They should make sure that the importance of those issues are carried out in different forms. But I think they cannot just downright block it because they don't, simply because they don't like the policies of abolishing the ministry. If anything, they have probably other opportunities in less than 5 years to revive it if they see fit.
Right. Well, the main opposition Democratic Party have criticized the plan. They've said that, in fact, they are open to changing the name of the ministry. We should point out at this point that the name in English and Korean are quite different. The official English name is Ministry of Gender Equality and Family. The official Korean name is 여성가족부, which is a direct, in a direct translation is Ministry of Women and Family. That has been a source of contention. So the DP are not insisting that the ministry keep its current name, but they are saying that the ministry should remain to handle increasing crimes targeting women and to meet the UN recommendation of an independent ministry addressing gender equality. Professor Kim, what do you make of their criticism and this plan as well?
I don't believe the DP's demand makes perfect sense here, because I have had people that I know inside the Ministry of Gender Equality working their officials, and I know details about how they've been operating, relatively speaking at least. I'm talking about my former students working there, so we have close communication with them. And the sense that I got was the ministry has been working very hard to come up with works to do, in fact. The overall things, I mean, they have come up with these works to help youth, for instance, and other things over the years. But the thing is, the mandate for the ministry has been rather limited from the very beginning, and this is a ministry where officials have been looking for works to do over the years. That I know as an inside story as a whole. So what I'm saying is, in terms of government efficiency, these are about people's welfare, basically. And I don't believe in having a ministry that serves half of the half of the population, but in its name it doesn't include the other half. I don't think it makes sense. As you mentioned, in Korean name it's a Ministry of Women, but what about the other half of the population? I don't believe that kind of the limited scope of service justifies itself. It has a lot of work to do, as Professor Song pointed out, going forward, of course, and that those kind of works can be done perhaps better and perhaps more efficiently without having interministerial boundaries. Rather, it could be resolved in a much more efficient way for people's health, people's welfare, and family affairs, and so on, through this reorganization plan. So I believe the government, Yoon government's plan this time announced, makes a good sense, and an opposition from the Democratic Party does not make as much of a good sense as a whole. And if I may add one more, now the abolished Ministry of Gender Equality and officials who've been working on this issue, they will continue work on these kind of issues belonging to different ministries. But government as a whole, they face a very challenging task ahead, because I'm very mindful of the population issue for this country. And so on the one hand, they'll have to continue their work of supporting family, supporting the welfare of the children, and so on. On the one hand, in order to ensure that Korea will continue to have population that maintains its rate of sound rate of growth, which we don't have at this point, on one hand, and also very fast increasing number of single person household, and then they need their protection, their welfare, and all these things, services and so on. So a government job is not necessarily providing disincentive to people, but rather providing incentive. So if we need incentive to maintain family and have a continuous growth of the population, that's good. But also those people who choose not to, they need protection. And those kind of works, there are a lot of work to do going ahead. And I think it would be better done without the Ministry of Gender Equality.
Professor Kim, you and Professor Song have both said part of the issue is the way the ministry has been operating. But there is a concern that if you get rid of the ministry, issues of gender equality will take a back seat, that it won't be in the focus as much. What do you make of those concerns, Professor Kim?
I think gender equality is an issue area that's far better addressed by politicians, lawmaking, and other areas. And devoting a ministry, single ministry, for the issue of gender equality itself is not the best kind of mechanism. For gender equality, we need better consensus among the people. And different kind of crimes against women, it has to be done through the law enforcement agencies and so on.
Professor Song, despite the announcement of these plans, there is a very steep uphill battle, as the revisions would require the consent of the National Assembly, as you've hinted at earlier. And with the DP holding a majority of 169 seats out of 300, it is set to face strong opposition. How likely do you think this plan will be realised? Do you think the administration will be able to reach some sort of compromise with the DP?
Well, they should. Their track record is not that good in terms of how they compromise. But I go back to the theme that this is a campaign issue, and also this is a situation where, by virtue of winning the election, the president has been at least given an opportunity to manage the affairs the way he sees fit with the organization he sees as the optimal. So I think that the opposition party should play a very tough negotiator on this issue. I think their voice has to be heard. But ultimately, this administration should be given an opportunity to move it the way they want. But I do worry about, because of the abolishment of this ministry, there's a voice that will be subtracted in the cabinet meeting, because there's no minister of gender equality anymore. As it is, the cabinet is heavily skewed towards male population.
Right.
So is that going to be a problem? I think it might be. I think that the president should be very mindful of the fact that no matter whether there is a ministry or not, the women's issue should be prevalent in the leadership in all places, especially in a cabinet meeting as well.
One more point on this very briefly before we move on. The difficulty of overcoming the DP majority in the National Assembly has always been known, and we always thought that was the reason why the administration had not pursued it earlier. So there are some who say that this announcement is a cynical ploy by the administration to divert criticism away from recent controversies by the president and to improve his flagging approval ratings. Professor Song, what do you make of that suggestion?
Well, that could may well be true. But I think that they'll at some point they have to get to their campaign pledges, and the restructuring of the government organization should take place earlier in the administration rather than later. So I don't see I can put those two together, but I don't think it's the main reason. I hope not. And also because of the to what they are suffering in terms of approval ratings and all those. I don't think this single issue can divert those issues. I think that the low approval rating and the kinds of leadership images that they're projecting to the people are pretty endemic in many different issues. Sure. So this is just one area.
So amid the revisions to the Government Organization Act that was announced, the plan to abolish the Gender Equality Ministry did cause the most noise, of course. But the administration also said they'll be looking into launching some new government agencies as well. It includes the establishment of a new government agency for Korean nationals abroad, Chewe Dongpocheong in Korean. There was also talk of a new agency for immigration issues as well, Imincheong in Korean, but those plans have been postponed for now. Professor Kim, what are your thoughts on the establishment of these agencies, particularly the Agency for Korean Nationals Abroad?
I don't support the idea. Particularly, I don't support the idea of setting aside the need for setting up the immigration agency. They're setting that aside, and then they chose to set up the Korean Nationals Abroad, Agency for Korean Nationals Abroad. And I think together it creates a concern, at least in my mind. That is, I have two issues in my mind. That is, our population problem, as all our listeners will understand what I mean by population problem. And then the other one is K-Wave related Korea's image going forward, keeping it up, and keeping it in the same pace. What I mean by that is, because this country is experiencing tremendous pace of the population decline, this is a time to open up the country. And it's particularly at this time when Korea is so popular, and I've seen with my own eyes teaching foreign students here in Korea how popular this Korea, this country is, how desirable this country is being viewed to the eyes of many young foreign people who have, I do know, as great talents. And it's my personal belief that Korea has to open up our doors to these talents in the face of a fast declining population. And in order to do so, I think the urgent task is to set up the Agency for Immigration first. And attached to that, when we are talking about the setting up the Agency for Korean Nationals Abroad, I'm just being reminded of this task. That is, I think our task, in my own view, is to play down on nationalism in this country and play up the patriotism. What's the difference between the two? In my definition, nationalism is about ethnicity, blood ties. If you're Korean, wherever you are, this government supports you. And if you're, then in addition to that, then I want to say, wherever you're born, if you want to join this country as a citizen, our door is open. I think that's even more urgent task than the former one. So personally, I don't support the idea of the current system of the voting. Korean nationals, Korean citizens living abroad who do not pay tax to the Korean government having votes, right to vote. Personally, I mean, other countries do it, but I just don't support that idea. And I think we have to focus on opening the gate and doors to the foreign nationals who will be willing to join this society as tax-paying citizens or tax-paying foreign nationals, whoever, come to this society and make this society and country continuously, the vibrant and dynamic. And I think that should be our focus. But I think that we have a wrong priority that's being shown in today's decision of announcing setting up the Agency of Korean Nationals Abroad and then setting aside the decision of delaying the decision of setting up the Agency for Immigration.
Interesting. Professor Song, what do you make of the establishment, the announcement today?
I probably would go a little bit differently than Professor Kim, although I understand his issues. I do support the Korean Nationals Abroad by setting up an agency. I think we can walk and chew at the same time. I do share the importance of having a sound immigration policy, especially as related to the population issues. But as Professor Kim actually pointed out, our soft power these days are one of the things that are making Korea more productive, not in a nationalist sense, but as a productive member of the global community. It's not just the people living overseas. We're not just looking to the Koreans, but by having them in the loop, we can promote many other things like the Korean language schools, exchange programs, internships, and also various networks economically, socially, and politically. You can think of Jewish networks overseas, diaspora networks like the Chinese and others. Hmm. A global network these days are very important. There's not much argument against that. So we can foster their well-being and also the network to promote diplomatic matters, but at the same time having a healthy network to help our domestic and foreigners alike. Mm. But I think that I do agree with the importance of the immigration issues, and that should be set up pretty quickly as well.
Professor Kim?
Yeah, managing and energizing diaspora network overseas should not become a task for the government, because it can create many different kind of misunderstandings. First of all, the point that I already mentioned, Korea being nationalistic, caring about ethnic Korean ties overseas, that kind of misunderstanding is not desirable. And the other one is also, you know, trying to use this kind of network to influence their local locality distance. So let me explain. A few years ago, about 10 years ago, there was a big controversy about the Jewish power in Israel power in the United States, how Israel may be manipulating or playing around with the Jewish population and elites in the United States and actually harming the national interest of the United States. There's a big debate about it. And actually, you know, just very prominent scholars raise a big voice about it and create a big, big controversy. So Korean government going out, you know, sticking out its neck and then supporting all these Koreans overseas, it could easily lead to very counterproductive results, the way I see it. So it's much better to support the private activities to encourage and strengthen and energize Korean network overseas rather than making it as a government work.
Sure. We're talking about very big, noble ideas, Professor Kim, but if I put my perhaps a petty political battles hat on. Unlike the abolishment of the Gender Equality Ministry, there is less opposition to the establishment of these agencies by the DP. So there are some who say that the administration should more actively pursue it, as it could be a rare case of bipartisan agreement, and that it could be packaged as a win for the administration.
I know that just reflects the sad reality, in my own view, my personal view, the sad reality of the remaining appeal or inclination towards more of the nationalism in this country, when we actually need, what we need is encouragement for patriotism for any people who are born wherever they were around the world and who are willing to join this country as its members. We need a switch, and we don't have that force behind the switch yet, and that's very much disappointing at this point in my view.
We'll have to wrap it up there. We've been speaking to Professor Song Se-ryong from Kyung University and Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-ju from the Hangul University of Foreign Studies. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 22.64 points, or 1.02% on Thursday, closing the day at 2,237.86. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 20.67 points, or 3.02%, closing the day at 706.01. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 7.71 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,402.41. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's our daily segment, Korea Trending, where we take a look at some of the other news stories that people have been looking up online in Korea Today. And for that, we have contributor Jenny Ha joining us in the studio to bring us those stories. Jenny, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Okay, let's head straight into our stories today. Okay. Jenny, what do you have for us first?
Police have issued an arrest warrant for a man in his 50s on charges of stabbing and killing his wife in broad daylight on Tuesday after four reports of domestic violence were filed against him. According to the Seosan Police Station in South Chungcheong Province on Wednesday, the 44-year-old woman was stabbed twice on a street in Seosan's Dongmundong and was taken to the hospital, and she was later pronounced dead. The man was caught by police at the scene after a witness reported the attack.
Yes, there is terrifying surveillance footage of the incident as well. And we say broad daylight. It was really literally in the middle of the day and on a very public road as well with bystanders. What do we know of the incident?
The 50-year-old suspect reportedly said he was drunk and did not remember anything during the police investigation. And according to the police, the suspect was separated from his wife on September 1st, when the first report of domestic violence was received. He then approached his wife on two occasions after the separation measures, after which the victim was granted a police protection order by the court. And the man was also asked to come in by the police, but he refused to, and asked to postpone the date.
Right, so despite the protection order, the attacker was still able to confront the woman then?
Yes, and generally when a victim protection order is issued, domestic violence perpetrators are prohibited from approaching within 100 meters of the victim and communicating with them. However, it is difficult to track in real time whether the perpetrator is approaching the victim. And on the day of the incident, the suspect is said to have committed the crime after an unannounced visit to the store that his wife operated. And the victim was assigned a smartwatch, which would have allowed her to place an emergency call directly to the police, but was not wearing it at the time of the incident. And in regard to this incident, women's groups and experts have pointed out that the legal system and measures against domestic violence crimes in the country are not sufficient to protect the victims.
Right. This incident comes not too long after the Sindang subway murder case as well, where a man murdered a subway worker despite the police and authorities knowing that he had been stalking the victim. She had been previously offered police protection as well. So there are growing calls for a better system to protect the victims and also to keep watch of the suspects as well, particularly if they do have violent tendencies.
Yes.
Okay, let's move on. What's the next story that you have for us?
A child reported missing was able to get home safely thanks to a concerned driver's text messages, according to an online post on Wednesday. The driver uploaded a post to an online community titled, "I Did Well, Right? I Saved a Child." And in the post, they detailed how they spotted a child standing on the shoulder of a highway in North Jeolla Province and reported it to the Korea Expressway Corporation.
Right, so the child was in a very dangerous spot. Do we know how the child ended up there?
No, we do not. But the child, who appeared to be an elementary school student, was standing alone on the shoulder of Honam Expressway with a backpack and a shoe pouch when they were spotted. The driver sent two text messages back-to-back to the Korea Expressway Corporation around 7 p.m., stating the location of the child, and followed up with a phone call. And a coworker who was also in the car called the police.
Yes, and they were able to locate the child then based on the driver's text messages.
Yes, the Korea Expressway Corporation confirmed the location of the driver and found the child through surveillance footage of the surrounding areas. And the police then returned the child safely to their home. The driver wrote in the post that it was dark and the child was wearing dark clothes, so the child could have died if they were not careful. And also a parent, the driver was worried that the child would get hurt and was happy that they returned home safely.
Yes, it's certainly a relief that the child was found safe and sound thanks to that driver who took the time to call the authorities rather than just drive by. Let's move on to our final story. What else has been trending today?
U.S. President Joe Biden was caught swearing on a hot mic on Wednesday during a visit to Fort Myers Beach, Florida, according to reports. Biden was visiting the town in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian to assess the damage caused by the storm, which affected the southeastern region of the United States.
Yes, this is the second incident in some 2 weeks where a president has been caught using profanities on a hot mic on camera. That's following President Yoon Suk-yeol, of course. So how did this happen?
So Biden dropped the F-bomb while exchanging greetings with Ray Murphy, the mayor of Fort Myers Beach. The U.S. president can be heard in video saying the equivalent of "no one messes with a Biden," which the mayor laughs off and agrees with his own expletive. Although the two men met for the first time on Wednesday, they are said to have gotten comfortable with each other relatively quickly, and Murphy remarked that the profanity didn't faze him at all in an interview with NBC News.
Yeah, so this is not Biden's first incident involving a hot mic, right?
Yes, in a little less friendly exchange in January, Biden was caught on camera cursing at a Fox News reporter, ridiculing a question that he had asked. The president reportedly called the reporter and apologized after the incident.
Yes, here in Korea, people will be looking to see how the White House deals with this sort of situation, considering the controversies that arose after President Yoon's recent incident. We'll wrap it up there for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Jenny, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
It's time now for our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we journey across the peninsula to discover some of the country's historical, cultural, and travel highlights. Joining us this week is our travel explorer, Hannah Roberts, with some suggestions of places for us to visit. Hannah, hello. It's great to see you again.
It's always good to see you too.
Okay, so what are you going to introduce us to today?
So today I have a festival recommendation for people who are currently visiting Seoul or who will be making their way here very soon. Mm. It's actually the biggest performing arts festival in the country, and it will be lasting for a whole month, so lots of time to see it. Mm. I'm talking about the Welcome Daehagno Festival, held in the well-known Iwa and Haewam neighborhoods of Seoul, on the famous Daehagno, which translates into English simply as University Street.
Right, so Daehagno, a very famous area in Seoul, but can you explain a bit more for us why it's so famous?
Yes, Daehagno is a really well-established area and has a long history as being a center for higher education with connections to some of the best and oldest schools in Korea. Mm. Sungkyunkwan University, the oldest educational institute in Korea, was relocated to its current location on Daehagno at the beginning of the Joseon Dynasty and has remained there ever since. Mm. In the same area in 1946, Seoul National University, one of the most prestigious universities in the country, was founded following the amalgamation of 9 different higher educational schools across Seoul. Mm-hmm. And then in 1975, Seoul National University relocated to their current position on Kwanak Mountain in the south of the city. And in its place on Daehagno, they built the Moronier Park.
Right, but nowadays, Daehagno is better known as the central location for the arts,
yes.
Right? How did that come about?
So nowadays, that area of the city is still home to several educational institutions, with many others located in the neighboring areas. However, with the exit of the main SNU campus came an influx of arts foundations and organizations setting up their home there, including the Korean Culture and Arts Foundation, which has led to the infallible link between the neighborhood and the arts. Mm. It also now houses a large selection of theaters and galleries, kind of going hand in hand with those foundations there.
Right.
Daehagno was designated a street of culture by the government in 1985. And in the outdoor performance areas, both on the street and the plazas in Moronier Park, those places, they frequently play host to street performances of music, dance, poetry and plays.
Right, so there are some comparisons to Broadway in New York, the West End in London. It's perhaps not as high profile as such, but when it comes to theatre and the performing arts in Korea, this is where it's at.
This is where it's happening.
Sure, I would say it actually feels a bit more like the Edinburgh Arts Festival, actually.
Definitely, yes.
But open all year round, of course. But Taengno does have its own festival, which is what we're talking about today. Now, tell us more about the Welcome Taengno Festival.
Yeah, the yearly arts festival held in the neighbourhood is, as we've said, called Welcome Taengno and happens every autumn for around a month. It was started in 2017, and although it was put on hold for a few years, it's back again this year. It started this past Saturday, the 1st of October, but it's going to end on October 30th, so there's lots of time to enjoy the many, many events that they have on offer. Mm. And yeah, when I say many, I really mean it. There are a whole host of different types of performances for people of all ages going on throughout the month, including plays, concerts, musicals, and dance performances.
Right, for more information on the festival and things that are going on, there is more information on their website, which we will get to in just a minute. Mm-hmm. But Hannah, before we get there, I understand there are other things that are going on as well, right?
Yes, that's right. If you want to learn more about the neighbourhood that the festival is taking place in, there's a free walking tour event on the 7th to the 10th of October. So it's not on the whole time. It's ending soon. But it's a really great opportunity because they'll take you through the Moronier Park. They'll walk along the Hangno Theatre Street and down to Naksan Park along the Seoul City Wall and then ending back in the Hangno area. Mm. As you walk, you can learn about the history of the neighbourhood, but at each stop, they also have special activities organised, little games and chances to win things.
Right.
The tour is all in English. It lasts 2.5 hours and is totally free, and you can apply on their website.
Oh, okay. So it's a free walking tour. That's fantastic. Okay.
As well as the walking tour, there's a stamp collection event where you can win a small prize if you collect the stamps of 8 iconic locations in the Daehangnong area. And the good thing about this event is that it's on an app. It's not a traditional stamp on a card. So you don't have to worry about losing a piece of paper. You download the app and collect the stamps and get your prize.
Sure, okay.
Yeah. So if you check the website, which is welcomedaehangno.com, and that's spelled welcome, Daehakro, they have a page called Daehangno Foodie 30, where the organizers have compiled a recommendation list of 30 of the best restaurants, coffee shops and shopping spots to stop by in the area.
Right. And of course, most of those can be enjoyed all year round as well. Right. So how do we get to Daehangno then?
So the famous Daehangno Street is located at Haewa Station on the light blue line, which is line 4, at exit 2. And that's the same exit that you can take to get to Moronier Park. And the various events and performances are being held across that whole area around that station.
Right. Sounds easy enough. And where can we go to get more information on the shows that are being put on during the festival?
Yeah. So like I said already, the festival's website is welcomedaehangno.com. And on there, they have a long list of all their shows, the locations and the dates that they're on, as well as links to the sites you need to access to make bookings. The main website is actually really easy to navigate, thanks to its language options, including Korean, English, Chinese and Japanese. Mm. But it's worth noting that if you want to go to any of the shows, some of the booking websites might only be in Korean and they might require a Korean bank card.
Right, so that's an important, information to have as well. But I've looked at the website and it does seem like there is a lot going on. As you said, plays, comedy shows, all sorts of things. The more I think about it, the more it does feel like Edinburgh as well, actually, just looking at that.
It really does.
So that's the Welcome Taengno Festival and it has already started. So do go check it out if you can. There is still plenty of time. That's where we'll wrap things up. Hannah, thank you for letting us know about this festival and we'll talk to you again soon.
Talk to you soon.
This is Swiss flutist Philipp Jund. I am professor of flute at Neuchâtel Conservatory in Switzerland and at Gangnam University in Korea. You are listening to Korea 24.
We've come to our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers. And for that, we have joining us in the studio now our staff editor, Richard Larkin. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Django.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
So yesterday was the start of the Busan International Film Festival, or the BIFF. It is a big festival with many famous actors and directors attending. And one of the guests this year was Hong Kong actor Tony Leung. The actor sat down for a press conference today in Busan to talk about a variety of topics. And you can find all the details in Kwak Yun-soo's article in the Entertainment and Arts section of the Korea Times.
Yes, I believe the reason why he was holding that press conference was because the actor was awarded the Asian Filmmaker of the Year Award for his contribution to the Asian film industry at the Busan International Film Festival. Tony Leung, he is, of course, a legendary veteran actor who's starring in films for decades now.
4 decades, to be exact. For those who may not know, the actor has starred in films like Chungking Express in 1994. This is a film which I'm sure many people have seen, and it is one that I have really enjoyed. He also starred in the 2002 films Infernal Affairs and Hero, which was actually nominated for the Best Foreign Language Film at the Academy Awards in 2003. Again, another movie I enjoyed. This is the first time he has visited the BIFF in 18 years, and he seemed to have a lot of praise for Korean content.
Okay, so with that praise he gives, does that mean he is a fan of Korean content?
That's what he said himself. The actor said he is a big fan of Korean cultural content and actors like Jeon Do-yeon and Song Kang-ho. Leung also made a surprise statement. The actor said he would love to star in Korean films and dramas. He added that if the role doesn't have a language barrier, then he would seriously consider it. So who knows, maybe we'll see the veteran actor in a Korean film or drama in the future.
Yes, he of course starred in Shang-Chi, the Marvel film, last year, I believe, and he made waves in Hollywood for his amazing turn in that as well. So I'm sure Korean cinema fans would love to see him in a Korean film as well at some point. Okay, let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
Next is an article that will interest coffee lovers. You can find Kim Hae-yeon's article in the Weekender section of the Korea Herald. The article gives you all the details you need to know about this year's Gangnam Coffee Festival, which kicks off this week.
Yes, the coffee industry, particularly the specialty coffee industry, has really boomed in Korea over the last few years. So tell us, when does the festival start and where is it held?
So it is a 4-day festival and it will be held in Gangnam Olympic Park Ice Arena from Friday. According to the article, the first 2 floors are dedicated to coffee brewing, tasting and selling products. And you will also find food trucks just outside of the arena.
That sounds perfect for coffee aficionados. Assume there will be events as well?
There will be. The festival signature program called 100 People, 100 Tastes will take place. I'm sure you can guess by the name, but this is where 100 participants will present their coffee extraction methods at the same time. You can also find barista tournaments during the festival. One is the Korea Brewers Cup from Friday to Sunday. The results will be announced on the last day and the winner will compete at the 2022 World Brewers Cup. This is just one of the tournaments that will take place on the weekend.
Yes, for more information, check out tomorrow's Korea Herald. That's where we'll leave it for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Richard, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
And that's all for our show today as well. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
Don't even think about checking that message or texting back. Did you know it only takes 3 seconds after a driver's attention has been diverted from the road for a crash to occur? Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident than driving under the influence of alcohol. Sending or reading a text message causes drivers, on average, to take their eyes off the road for 5 seconds. When driving at 80 kilometers per hour, that means that drivers travel approximately the length of a football field with their eyes closed. At KBS World Radio, we value our listeners' safety and well-being. If you're listening to our programs while driving via your mobile device, please hit play before you set off on your journey. If you receive a message or call while driving, either use a hands-free Bluetooth device to respond or wait until you've arrived at your destination. You're not just putting your life at risk. Distracted driving accounts for approximately 25% of all motor vehicle crash fatalities. Arrive alive.
KBS World Radio.